This is one of the sounds of the space age. Hear this and other big news stories of the year on 1961 Review over this station soon.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer to.
That, believe it or not, is the voice of a computer. And if you don't believe a computer can sing, tune in this station for the 1961 Review.
The Year in Perspective, a capsule history in sound and word.
Was a year of great hopes and great anxieties, of great conflicts and crises and small progress toward resolving them. A year that brought back familiar names in a different and sometimes tragic vein. Hammarskjöld, Castro, Khrushchev. In the perspective of time, these events stand out. On January 20th, the United States inaugurated its 35th president. The young senator from Massachusetts became the first Roman Catholic and the youngest man ever to hold that office. The voice of John Fitzgerald Kennedy in his inaugural address challenged East and West alike.
Let both sides seek to invoke the wonders of science instead of its terrors. Together let us explore the stars, conquer the deserts, eradicate disease, tap the ocean depths, and encourage the arts and commerce. Let both sides unite to heed in all corners of the earth the command of Isaiah to undo the heavy burdens and let the oppressed go free.
The youthful president's initial impact on the nation was considerable. But just as he was getting established in the White House, a voice from across the seas electrified the world with this announcement.
Today, the first cosmic spaceship named Vostok with a man on board was orbited round us from the Soviet Union. He is Airman Major Yuri Gagarin, an Air Force pilot, a citizen of the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republic.
A man in space. Fulfillment of one of man's oldest dreams, to escape the bonds of gravity. Official Washington sent Moscow congratulations. But the pall of gloom that hung over the U.S. was unmistakable. The Russians had beaten America into space. But in early May, after much delay and agonizing postponements...
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, ignition, liftoff, and 34 minutes after the hour.
America had done it. Navy Lieutenant Commander Alan B. Shepard was in space. The years of preparation and snail-like progress were all forgotten. From the fringes of space came his voice.
0.8G, 8 PSI, Kevin, and the oxygen is go. Kevin pressure is holding at 5.5. Kevin holding at 5.5. Oxygen go.
After the dramatic recovery, Commander Shepard appeared at a news conference. He explained in detail how he felt during the trip and then observed,
"Didn't really feel the flight was a success until the recovery had been successfully completed. It's not the fall that hurts, it's a sudden stop."
In the summer of the year, the United States tried again.
3, 2, 1, ignition, liftoff, liftoff.
There she goes! You can hear the roar as it slowly lifts from its pad. A streaming flame behind it as it goes straight up into the air. Listen to that roar. There goes astronaut Virgil Gus Grissom on his ride into space. America's second spaceman is on his way.
Gus Grissom has just reported. He has just reported 0G and reported that, boy, that sun is really bright.
Gus Grissom, too, faced the throng of reporters and cameramen after he returned. Asked how he felt during the trip, Grissom revealed that our superhuman astronauts have normal human emotions.
"Well, I was scared a good portion of the time. I guess this is a pretty good indication."
"You were what?"
"Scared." "Okay."
There were even more U.S. space triumphs during the year. The Saturn, believed to be the most powerful rocket ever launched, was successfully flight tested.
"This rocket, as she takes off, will have the power equivalent to 300,000 conventional automobiles, and later models will be even more powerful. Ignition! Blast off! Orange flame to all sides! Fire under the tail, and up the Saturn goes! She's rising very slowly, I might say agonizingly slowly, but going up and going straight up. A glorious needle of silver and orange, now it's white. White flame beneath the tail of the Saturn. Up she goes and up, and she's going straight. And every second that the Saturn goes is a triumph. Every second this giant continues is considered a triumph by rocket men."
On August 29th, a young chimp named Enos was blasted aloft from Cape Canaveral, orbited twice around the world, and brought safely back to Earth. At a news conference later that afternoon came the announcement.
"Two pilot teams have been selected for Project Mercury's initial manned orbital space flight. John H. Glenn Jr. has been selected for the first flight, with Scott Carpenter acting as backup. Alan B. Shepard will act as pilot technical advisor for this team, and Gordon Cooper will head up the pad emergency escape and launch area recovery team."
There were rumors for some weeks that the United States might try to orbit Glenn before the first of the year. But the 40-year-old astronaut will have to wait. NASA decided to wait until January before attempting the feat. The U.S. and her allies had hoped that history could record both major world powers as having orbited a man in the same calendar year. A few hundred miles south of Cape Canaveral in Castro Land, there were rumblings. The first word came from the UPI listening post in Miami.
"An invasion force landed in south central Cuba this morning, some 90 miles from Havana, and it's fighting its way toward the capital. Fighting is furious, and according to Red Cross reports heard via radio from Cuba, casualties must be heavy. Premier Fidel Castro issued a statement over a nationwide network shortly after 11 this morning, saying that the invaders, members of the exiled Cuban Revolutionary Front, have come to destroy the revolution and take away the dignity and rights of man."
An invasion of Cuba by exiles. It came as no surprise that that voice from across the seas had a comment on the invasion, and the comment itself was no surprise either.
"This is Radio Moscow, and here is the news. Early this morning, armed aggression against revolutionary Cuba began. Armed bands of mercenaries were landed in different parts of the island. The United States has officially given the Cuban counter-revolutionaries financial aid, has equipped them with the latest weapons, and put at their disposal airplanes and warships. Moreover, only 3 days ago, President Kennedy declared that the United States would never take aggressive action against Cuba. All this was merely the necessary camouflage to conceal the criminal plans that were being made against Cuba and to distract attention from the coming aggression.
American officials heatedly denied such charges. From the United Nations, American Ambassador Adlai Stevenson spoke.
Dr. Roa, speaking for Cuba, has just charged the United States with aggression against Cuba and invasion coming from Florida. These charges are totally false, and I deny them categorically.
Mr. Stevenson's denial was reinforced by President Kennedy.
I have emphasized before that this was a struggle of Cuban patriots against a Cuban dictator. While we could not be expected to hide our sympathies, we made it repeatedly clear that the armed forces of this country would not intervene in any way.
The fighting went on. Casualties were high on both sides, but the only word from the interior was that of Castro's Radio Cuba.
Pueblos de América y del mundo. El imperialismo
Cuba will be victorious. The revolution will live on. Hundreds of those who might have helped the invaders were arrested, some executed. Hundreds of the invaders themselves were captured, and Castro maintained his iron grip. 1961 was also the year of emerging new nations, not the least of these, the turbulent Congo. After a year of independence, blood still flowed in the streets, and at the United Nations, Ambassador Stevenson spoke the sentiments of many.
And now comes confirmation of the latest revolting acts, the massacre of 13 Italian airmen serving the United Nations, presumably by soldiers from Stanleyville. We are profoundly shocked by these actions, and our heartfelt sympathies go to their relatives as well as to the government of Italy. Their names are added to the long list of those who have lost their lives in the cause of peace in the service of the United Nations.
The fighting continued, with casualties heavy on all sides. Finally, the UN commander in secessionist Katanga province, Connor Cruz O'Brien, resigned. He charged flagrant obstruction by Britain and Rhodesia.
We have quite definitely experienced British and Rhodesian obstruction of the United Nations purposes in the Katanga.
But the small and bitter war raged on. The great tragedy of 1961 occurred when United Nations Secretary General Hammarskjöld was killed in a plane crash while on another of his Congo peace missions. His death stunned the world. One of the high points of his career had come when he adamantly refused to resign under Russian pressure.
It is very easy to bow to the wish of a big power. It is another matter to resist. If it is the wish of those nations who see in the organization their best protection in the present world, I shall do so again.
True to his promise, Dag Hammarskjöld had worked round the clock to preserve peace. Then the world gasped as the BBC told the story.
It's now been confirmed that the United Nations Secretary General, Mr. Hammarskjöld, has been killed in a plane crash. His body was found this afternoon about 7 miles from Ndola in northern Rhodesia, where he was to have met President Trombe of Katanga.
The United Nations was deeply affected by the loss, and for a time, its very existence as an effective force for peace seemed to be at stake. The assembly convened to pay its last respects, and hear Adlai Stevenson's eloquent and pointed eulogy.
Dag Hammarskjöld once said, at a moment of crisis in his life and in the life of this organization, that the man does not count, the institution does. Yet institutions are made to serve men, and it is from the greatest men that they derive their character and their strength. The memory of this one man, humane, cultured, judicious, possessed of a poetic and philosophic vision, free of passion other than a passion for the rule of reason and of decency, modest and brave, this memory will always be with us as a reminder of the best that the United Nations can be.
Hammarskjöld's body was flown from Rhodesia to his home in Sweden. The funeral services were eloquent in their very simplicity.
The coffin, draped in the Swedish flag, with one single wreath, and now bearing it very slowly down the center aisle, followed immediately by the members of the immediate Hammarskjöld family, King Gustav Adolf and Queen Louise, then bow to Mr. Manji Slim, the President of the General Assembly, and Mr. Barnes, the President of the Security Council, and take their places behind the coffin. From one side of the chancel come the personalities, the national personalities, from many countries. The coffin is now nearing the great west door.
The United Nations now faced its toughest time, the replacing of the Secretary General. The Russians proposed the Troika, or the three-man ruling body, then a four-power group, and finally five men to head the United Nations. After much debate, one man was finally picked to fill that tremendous gap left by the passing of Hammarskjöld, a quiet man from Burma, U Thant.
My country has steadfastly pursued over the years a policy of non-alignment and friendship for all other nations, whatever their ideologies. In my new role, I shall continue to maintain this attitude of objectivity and to pursue the ideal of universal friendship.
Perhaps the United Nations would weather the crisis. The world still waits to see. Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev long has touted a peaceful line when it served his purpose to do so. Not too long ago, he thundered that any nation which resumed testing of nuclear weapons would be inflicting a great wrong on humanity. But after long obstructionism at the Geneva test ban talks, the Russians broke off the discussions. Within 24 hours, they began poisoning the atmosphere with nuclear debris, fallout. The anti-bomb groups exploded into action. Among them, Bertram Russell's Committee of 100 in Great Britain. They staged a sit-in at the Soviet embassy in London. The BBC reported it this way.
Well, you're outside, but four other people are inside. Where are they sitting?
We were sitting in the large sitting room, quite comfortable, and the four members of the committee who are remaining, I came out to act as spokesman for my committee, and they intend to sit inside the embassy until they have an assurance from the Soviet government that they will not proceed with the testing of the 50 megaton bomb, as announced today.
Well, the Russian ambassador is no longer in this country, so how long do you think they're going to be inside there?
Well, that remains to be seen.
Are they prepared to be there all night, do you think?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Within the past hour, the four who had remained inside the embassy were carried out by the police
one by one.
Shortly after the Russians resumed their tests, President Kennedy revealed the American stand on the resumption of atmospheric tests.
Should such tests be deemed necessary to maintain our responsibilities for free world security in the light of our evaluation of Soviet tests, they will be undertaken only to the degree that the orderly and essential scientific development of new weapons has reached a point where effective progress is not possible without such tests.
If it becomes necessary, only time will tell. In the summer of 1945, the Nazis had finally crumbled. The second war to end all wars was over. But 16 years later occurred a brief moment belonging to the past and to the present. Both, yet neither. Under curious circumstances, a man was flown from South America to Israel. In April, he faced an Israeli court and the world.
Adolf, the son of Adolf Karl Eichmann, is accused hereby.
First count, nature of offense, crime against the Jewish...
Eichmann, a gaunt, pale, bespectacled figure, hardly looked the part. He was charged with slaughtering 6 million Jews as part of Hitler's plan. The state charged he herded these hapless human beings into crematoriums, gas chambers, or to face firing squads. Eichmann's defense? He countered that he was merely a soldier following a superior's orders, as any soldier must do.
Examination of the Jews in Section 23 of the Criminal Code Ordinance 1936. Particulars of offense. The accused during the period 1939 to 1945 committed in Germany a crime against humanity.
The three judges retired and, after deliberating for months, returned with a 300-page judgment, finding Eichmann guilty on all counts and surprising no one. Least of all Eichmann, who had told the court last July that he fully expected the death penalty. Since the close of World War II, Berlin has been a city divided. Russia in the east, in a sector which remains a grim reminder of the ravages of war. England, France, and the United States in the west, where skyscrapers, apartments, and autos line the broad streets. For months, refugees streamed across the border to freedom in the West. And on August 22nd, the voice of Germany reported the beginning of the end.
The British commandant in Berlin, Major General Delacombe, has had four tanks posted on the sectoral boundary between West Berlin and the Soviet zone. He came to this decision after people's policemen from the Soviet zone had appeared on the boundary at Stacken, part of the city, and begun to lay a barbed wire barricade along a 1.5 mile stretch. News is being broadcast by loudspeakers from the West Berlin side into the Soviet zone to the southeast of the city. The crowd of people who gathered on the Soviet sector's side were dispersed by people's police using tear gas. This news broadcast comes to you from the Voice of Germany.
The wall grew. Crossing points became fewer in number. Strict security by the People's Police was maintained. A huge no-man's land was cleared to provide a clear line of fire at fleeing refugees. But there were many. Houses and even churches fronting the wall were evacuated and sealed off. Still, desperate people leaped from upper stories, trying to hit Western fire nets held only a few feet beyond the wall. West Berlin's Mayor Willy Brandt visited the city, and he told the imprisoned East Berliners that they would not be forgotten. We, he said, are one with you.
Wir Deutsche werden unserer Verpflichtung für Sie immer eingedenk bleiben.
Chancellor Adenauer also visited the border and found the East Germans had arranged a reception for him. A PA system designed to drown out any speech he might feel inclined to make.
The music now was an extraordinary affair, someone identified as a number entitled The Old Red Indian Chief, and it echoed off the neighboring buildings in a deafening blast full of whoops and war cries. smiled bravely but grimly. "I just listened to that," he said. And now the loudspeaker voice shouted, "Too late, Mr. Chancellor. We've acted in the meantime."
Freedom-loving peoples the world over protested. U.S. State Secretary Rusk commented,
"The wall certainly ought not to be a permanent feature of the European landscape. I see no reason why the Soviet Union should think that it is to their advantage in any way to leave there that monument to communist failure."
But the wall remained, even strengthened and extended, narrowing the few remaining gaps to freedom. In just about 60 seconds, you'll be able to say, "Now I've heard everything," and mean it. Bell Telephone Laboratories has finally come up with the ultimate, a computer that not only can think, but talk, even sing. Listen.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer to. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage, but you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
Machine, you've gone too far. Take over the world if you like, but please, leave the romance department to us. This, then, is 1961. Not all of it by any means, but those events which attracted the public's eyes and ears. Perhaps history will assess other happenings as more important. But, for the present, these were the things that gripped our hearts and minds.
This has been 1961 in Review, a capsule documentary of living history in word and sound, produced by United Press International.